My name is Tyler Preston. I was born in Lake Tahoe, California, Truckee, California. I served in Afghanistan on the USS Carl Vinson, stationed off the coast of Afghanistan, in the first response to September 11th. I served in the Navy. I achieved the rank of E5, which is Petty Officer Second Class. This interview is being conducted in Missoula, Montana. The interviewers' names are Julia Capron and Mackenzie Enich. This interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress.
Okay, so when and where were you born?
I was born in Lake Tahoe, California. Truckee, California.
And when?
July 26th, 1979.
So give me some family details. Like, what did your parents do? Did you have any siblings?
I have one sister. I'm the oldest. We were separated by 13 months. My father's in construction. And my mother is a ballet instructor, Pilates instructor, health nut person.
Great. Did you have any siblings growing up?
Just one sister.
Oh, right. You said that. Sorry. what did you do before you entered the service?
Well, I had probably 15 jobs before I entered the Navy. I did a whole lot of everything. I built computers, construction with my dad. I started working when I was 13. The job that I had directly before I joined the Navy, I worked at True Value. I was the paint department manager.
So. Okay. Did you have any other family members who served in the military?
Yes, I'm the fifth generation Navy.
And can you maybe elaborate on that? Like, what did they do?
My dad was a gunner's mate in Vietnam. My grandfather, I know, was on a submarine. Past that, I really don't know.
Very cool. How did you enlist in the service, or did you get drafted?
There hasn't been a draft since Vietnam.
Okay.
I enlisted. I walked into the recruiter's office, and I walked up to his desk, and I said, I want to be in boot camp in 2 weeks. And he said, can't do it. And I said, okay, I'll go to join the Air Force. And he said, wait. I'll take this test. I took the test, and he said, okay, what do you want to be? So I told him I wanted to be a parachute rigger. And he said, okay, sign this paperwork. 2 weeks later, I was in boot camp.
And can you tell me a little bit, like, what was boot camp like being a parachute rigger?
It didn't matter. Everybody does the same thing, mm-hmm. And it wasn't fun. Prior to boot camp, I had considered being a Navy SEAL. That was what I wanted to be, and after boot camp, I knew that I didn't want to do that. I don't like to swim. I found out I don't swim very well, so I decided that I was going to cancel that and just go to be a parachute rigger, so that's what I did.
So, what was, like, leaving for training camp, like boot camp, and then what kinds of things did you do?
Well, it's very confusing. There are a lot of people nowadays, anyways, when they join the military, they join in the DEP program, DEP, Delayed Entry Program. And basically what you do is you sign up saying that you're going to join. And once you sign that paperwork, there's no out. There's no way you can get out of it. And then you go through a booklet and you complete a bunch of steps and you get people to sign off on it saying that you're learning the ranks and you know who you're talking to and you know who you call sir and you know who you don't. And I didn't do any of that. So I was very confused when I went in because I walked in and they said, stand here and raise your hand and say these words. And okay, there's the bus. That bus took me to the airport and I got on a plane and flew to Chicago and that was it. It was done. So I remember when we got off the plane going into boot camp, we got on the bus and we go over to the boot camp. We get on base and the first person, they yell at you, everybody's standing against the wall, and then they yell at you for leaning against the wall, and then they tell you to stand at attention. And, you know, I knew what attention was, but that was just about it. I didn't know anything else. And I remember a petty officer, third class, come up to me and started yelling at me, and I said, sir, and he said, I'm not a sir. And I said, yes, sir. You don't understand the lingo. You don't know who's who and who's, you know, big business and who's just a peon. And, I mean, after 11 years, I learned a whole lot. And, you know, I still call people sir because it's respectful, you know. But it was very confusing. But you pick up quite quickly as far as what you need to do. And when they tell you to drop, you drop.
Wow. Okay, so recording?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you have any specialized training for your parachute rigging?
Yes.
Okay, do you elaborate on that?
The school for survival equipment is it's a 2-month school, and I went through it in 6 weeks. We were a rushed class because the Navy was short on us, and so they wanted to get us out in the field quickly. The school covers all the basics because it's not just a parachute rigger. You don't just do parachutes. There's every piece of survival equipment you can imagine, from water purification tablets to life rafts for surviving at sea. Basically anything that a pilot would need if they had to eject over land or water, I was in charge of. It's when they sit us down in the room for the very first time in class, they sit us all there and they walk in, they have a pilot come in, and they have a pilot who's punched out come in to tell you a story of how he survived ejecting. And we haven't had a lot of people punch out behind enemy lines lately, but it does happen. But after he left, they looked at us and they said, look, you will be going to work every day under the penalty of imprisonment. Because if you fail to do your job, someone dies. If someone dies, you go to jail. So I had that yoke around my neck for 11 years. And it got to me at the end. That's one of the reasons why I got out. Just couldn't deal with it anymore. But the school itself was pretty intense. They show you how to pack a parachute. They show you how to test a life raft and store it in the survival seat. They always ask us, what's the primary objective of a survival seat? It's to sit on. It's not for ejection. It's not for survival. It's just to sit on. But everything that goes in it has our hands in it. One crossed line could be a dead pilot. One life raft that has a leak could be 4 dead people. You know, our job was crucially important, and my shop was the very last shop a pilot would go to before they get in an aircraft and fly and leave the aircraft carrier and go over and do what they do. So it was very personal job. I took it very personal. A lot of people didn't. A lot of people just came in to work and it was just a job. I took it very, very personal. So.
So what was adapting to military life like? Like what kind of physical strains did you have? What were like the living situations like, the food, social life? Just kind of give us like a...
You want in general or on the carrier or...
Just first in general and then...
Yeah, and then anything you think would be important for us to know.
Give me the... You got three different points in there, right?
Yeah.
Where were they again?
Actually, four.
Four?
Physical regimen, living space, food, and social life.
So the physical readiness test, which is conducted twice a year, you had to run a mile and a half in a certain amount of time. You had to do a certain amount of push-ups and a certain amount of sit-ups. It's different for every branch. You know, in the Marines, they did pull-ups. That was added in for Marines. I was stationed in a couple different Marine squadrons in Japan. When you're in the Navy and you're stationed with Marines, you're expected to perform as a Marine, even though you're not a Marine and you've never done pull-ups and it doesn't matter to you. despite what a lot of people say, equal treatment against, you know, men and women. Women are allowed to be in combat, but they're not required to do the same amount of sit-ups. They're not required to do the same amount of push-ups. They're not required to run at the same speed. So there is no equal treatment. The men were always expected to perform higher. When I was over there, women weren't technically allowed to be on the front lines, but they were there. I remember straight out of boot camp, I ran the mile and a half in just over 9 minutes. And the longer I served, the more I realized you don't get extra credit for doing a good job. So I laxed up and I became the 12-minute man. Anybody who wanted to be 12 minutes, which was passing, but not outstanding, but not failing, it's just a passing grade, you're good to go. Everybody ran with me, and I always ran 12 flat every time until the end. You know, I had two herniated discs in my thoracic spine, so I didn't even do a physical readiness test for the last year and a half I was in. I was waived because of my injuries. I had a blown out shoulder, and I mean, I couldn't do push-ups, I couldn't do sit-ups, running hurt. I could run, but not very efficiently. But, you know, those tests get to you. They wear on you. And I know I saw an article in one of the military newspapers the other day about people getting so stressed out about the measurements, because they measure your waist and your chest, your neck, and that people were going out and getting liposuction just to pass a test because they didn't want to get kicked out. So, I mean, there's a lot of stress on physical readiness, and which there should be. I mean, you could be sent over there at any time. So, as far as living quarters, I always liked being stateside because, you know, when lower enlisted, when you're in first starting out, you were living in the barracks, which is pretty much like a college dorm. I mean, it looks just like a hotel room, you know. A lot smaller, but they don't give you a TV. They give you cable hookup, but you got to buy a TV. And, you know, starting out, when I went in, I was only 19 when I went in. I didn't have anything to my name. Everything was at my parents' house. So I started out, you know, you go to a thrift store and buy a little TV, and you got a little room with a little dinky fridge and, you know, a couple friends living on the same floor as you. But the longer you stay in, the higher you get, the higher you get, the more money you make, and the more money you make, the more opportunity you get to live out in town. And it's kind of like being a freshman going to school. They make you live in the dorm just to experience it. But once you get a little farther up there, they'll give you some freedoms, and you get to go to the frat houses and, you know, stuff like that. You know, there's groups and friends, and some people take it differently. I never took anybody that I met as a lifelong friend. You know, I was people I met, people I served with, people I lived with. Some of them I can't even remember their names. You know, there's only a handful of people that I still are even in communication with after 11 years. But some people are different. Some people are really affectionate about the people they meet, and they stay in contact with them. They, you know, write them and email them and stuff like that. But it wasn't like that for me. I was all business all the time. So as far as food goes, Base Galley's better than a college, you know, what they serve at the college. It was good food, but the people that are making the food are just cooks that went through boot camp, that went to culinary school, and they're just making you slop and slapping it on your plate, you know. What was the other one?
Food.
Social life. Social. Yeah, I talked about that. For me, I mean, when you get out of work, you usually hang out with the people you work with, and you get to know them pretty well. And the thing is that people come and go every year. You know, you get there, and somebody else is there, already been there for 2 years, and you hang out with them for 2 years, and then, boom, they're gone. And they're halfway across the world or on the other side of the United States, and you just lose touch with people. But sometimes, my very first command was, I was there for 5 years, because when I joined in, I joined up for five instead of the minimum of four. So I was there, I had been at that command longer than anybody else in that entire command, including higher-ups, XOs, COs, all the officers. Everybody came and went. I had three different XOs, COs and XOs, my first command. I had been there the longest, and I had seen, my first command, I think we had 350 people. So I had seen 349 of them come and go, you know, several times. I even had, there was three or four people that I knew that actually was there, left, came back, and left again before I even left. So people come and go, they're in and out of your lives, and kind of single-serving friends and company. But there are a couple people that stuck around. You know, one of my best friends and my roommates, he ended up being my best man in my wedding, and I still talk to him to this day. So some of them make an impression on you, and you know, stick around forever. But
can I ask a question real quick? Mm-hmm. So how'd that like constant flux of people where you were there the longest, so mm-hmm. how did that change your view of relationships and friendships outside of military?
You mean present day?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. In my school, in my program that I'm in, there are a few people that I've made friends with, that I talk with, but I haven't exchanged phone numbers with anybody. I don't communicate with anybody outside of school. I haven't seen anybody that I know from school out in town or anything like that. And I think that's just kind of like my lifestyle. I'm married. I don't have any kids. And my wife is my passion. You know, I love to hang out with her. It's kind of hard right now because we're on opposite shifts. She works in the mornings, and I get home from school, and she's got 4 hours before she goes to bed, and I'm just kind of hanging out there alone until I go to bed. But I think that's pretty much my choice, our choice. You know, she pretty much does the same thing. It's just, I've lived here in Montana for 3 years. So it's a new place. We kind of threw a dart at a map and ended up here, and we don't know anybody from here. I had grandparents that lived down the Bitterroot, but they left a long time ago. So I don't have, neither of us have family here. So it's just kind of us against the world. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you. Did you want to take over for a little bit?
So, this is a question that we kind of brainstormed in class. How did you feel when you first put on a uniform?
Are you trying to make me cry?
No.
When I first took my oath, I was in civilian clothes. And it didn't mean very much to me. To me, it was just a new job, a new adventure, a new place, a new destination. When I first put on a uniform, I didn't really understand the meaning of it. You know, my parents always instilled in me a sense of pride. And the longer I served, the more I understood what it meant. So it still means a lot to me today.
So tell me a little bit about where you served.
So I told you that my first command I was in for 5 years. I was stationed in a fighter attack squadron. Every fighter attack squadron is given a number. My fighter attack squadron was called 22, VFA 22. We were the Fighting Redcocks. And that's actually the name, and we had a mascot. The mascot was a fighting chicken, it's a redcock. His name was Romeo. 7, because we had, they get kidnapped, held for ransom by other squadrons. And the pride of being in that squadron, I mean, it's a very historic squadron. They were heavily involved in Vietnam. They've been around for a long time, been in many campaigns. And the thing about it is, you know, yeah, we have pilots, and the pilots do the business, but the pilots don't do their business without us. You know, everybody in that squadron pulled their weight. Parachute riggers, you know, instead of working on survival equipment, we'd be out there tearing apart the plane and fixing it and helping out with other squadron or other shops and things like that. So the whole squadron is very tight-knit, very proud of that squadron and being in that squadron. And my first, I was in that squadron for a year and a half before we actually deployed. Before you deploy on an aircraft carrier, there are certain things you have to do. You had to qualify, the pilots have to qualify for landings on the aircraft carrier. So you got to go out to the aircraft carrier for 3 weeks where they do tests and they land and fly. And we just kind of sit around twiddling our thumbs. You also got to go to Fallon. NAS Fallon, which is in Nevada, and they drop dummy bombs on a target range, and they got to qualify to, you know, they got to hit so many targets to be able to qualify, and so there's a lot of build up before you go to the actual deployment. So our first deployment, we went out on the aircraft carrier, the USS Carl Vinson, and we thought it was just routine, you know. Everybody, at that point, every carrier was still going to Iraq, and then they were doing, you know, just maintaining the peace in Iraq. This is before the Iraq war and everything like that, the second one. We never left the first time, but that's why we would go over there. We were on our way over there. We were 2 days out of Singapore when September 11th happened, and I knew then that we were going to war. Um, trying to think if I can actually say what I was about to say. No, screw it. I'm out anyway, so it doesn't matter. When something like that happens, right, a national crisis, we're attacked, you've got carriers, you've got ships all around the world. Certain people make choices, and they decide whether or not you're going to go. And when they make the decision that you're going to go, they shut down all communication to the ship. So only certain people can actually make phone calls or receive phone calls or email, anything like that. So imagine 6,000 people sitting on a ship, and 9:30 at night, the ship stops. We hear the anchor drop. Everybody's watching TV. Everybody's watching the same channel. And everybody's seeing the same exact thing. And nobody's saying a word. And then you realize, you got to tell your parents where you're at. You got to tell your family where you're at. You try to send an email and it won't go out. You run to the nearest phone and you try to make a call and you can't call. They do it for a reason. They don't want anybody telling anybody where they're going and how long it's going to take to get there and things like that. It's called operational security. OPSEC. But it's pretty frustrating. I received an email from my dad. Historically, looking back, I wish I still had it. I've tried to get it. I'm sure the NSA has a copy of it, but my father wrote me an email. Was in all caps. He didn't know that we had seen what had happened. So he described to me in all caps everything that had happened that day. I'm the kind of person that if I was not in the military, I would have been in New York helping look for bodies. But I knew that I was in a better place, because I knew that I would be one of the first ones to respond to it. So that was my first 2 years in the Navy.
What were your first thoughts when you guys heard the news?
So I remember, keep in mind, I was lower enlisted. I think I was in E4. When this all happened. I had just come out of the chow hall. My shift, I was working the night shift, and we had just finished up eating, and we had just reported to the shop. And it was a transitional period. You know, day check and night check were both there at the same time. I worked from, my starting hours was 8. I think it was 8 to 8. 8 o'clock at night to 8 o'clock in the morning. 12-hour days, 24 hours a day, no time off for 6 months. So, you know, it was the beginning of the cruise. So, I mean, emotions were still pretty high. Everybody was pretty excited about, you know, getting out there and seeing things. And, I mean, that's why I joined the Navy. I wanted to see the world. So my shift had just reported, and we had every TV. Every shop is established with a television connection. Some shops don't have TVs. Some supervisors take the TVs away because they don't want their people watching TV anymore because they're watching TV and not working, sort of thing. And there's one channel that you can watch. That's the flight deck channel, and it shows – it's a black and white projection of what's going on in the flight deck. So you can see planes coming in and landing, and it's – at flight deck level, so you see planes coming in over the top and landing. It's a pretty cool view, and usually during the transition period, it's on that channel. And I remember that day I was surprised when I came in because they were changing the channel around. And I said, "What's going on?" And they said, "We don't know. We're still trying to figure it out." And they finally stopped on CNN, on news, and I remember the smoke coming out of the North Tower, and I said, what happened? They said, we don't know. We think a plane hit the tower. We don't know what's going on. And I said, is this real or is this a movie? I mean, that's a pretty screwed up movie. And as soon as I said that, the second plane hit. I watched the second plane hit live. And we watched it explode. And we watched it burn. And I looked at the people that worked for me and I said, we're going to war. I knew right then that we were under attack. To hear the halls and the pathways and the carrier, everybody was silent. Nobody said anything. It's surreal, you know? So I got that email from my dad. And at the end of the email, he said, I know you're safe because you're in the safest place in the world. I knew he was right. You know, what better place to be than beyond the tip of the spear? You know? So, I'm sorry, it's still so emotional.
It's fine, we can take a break if you want to.
Yeah. I think I'm all right.
Okay. Well, we can transition to a slightly, maybe happier note. I was actually just wondering if Neptune Day is still, or like crossing the equator, is that still a thing? Did you ever take part in that?
I cannot comment on that.
Okay. All right.
Yes, it does still exist. Okay. I can't say anything more.
Sounds good.
Do you have any details about the trip abroad?
When you see something as terrible as the towers fall and the Pentagon hit, so many people dead, it really makes you stop and think. Think about tomorrow. Think about whether or not you'll wake up. Think about whether or not you'll make it home. It makes you think about your job. Makes you think about, is this pilot going to have to use this ejection seat? Is the chute going to open? When you have nothing but time on your hands, makes you think a lot. When you think a lot, you have to go to a peaceful place. There's a spot on the carrier just outside of my shop where I worked on the catwalk where I would go and I would sit and I would look at the ocean. And I realized people pay good money to go and see this view that I'm looking at right now. I cherished every day that I had the ability to go out there and watch the sunrise. And every day I had the ability to go out and watch the sunset. Some of the most beautiful sights I've ever seen is absolutely nothing but ocean. I've seen flying fish. I've seen dolphins following, chasing our aircraft carrier. I've seen whales. I've seen a sea of jellyfish. I remember we were getting close to Thailand, and I was sitting out there one day, and a butterfly came and landed on the catwalk rail. And I knew we were getting close to land. Just little things like that, you know. I remember I cornered our rear admiral one day. a lot of people won't talk to these people because they're so high up, you know. I knew this guy. I knew him well. You know, he had broken his nose 7 times, and he needed a custom mask built for his face, shaped for his face, because he was a flying admiral, and most admirals don't fly. When I say admiral, I mean carrier group admiral. I was a 3-star admiral for the entire carrier group, which was 7 ships. People don't talk to this guy. There's one guy who walks around with him, who makes sure that everybody, you know, treats him with respect and blah, blah, blah. Well, I knew this guy, and I was his actual personal parachute rigger. I made his mask for him and made sure everything was good to go. And we had been to sea for so long that we had 2 beer days. It's just, you only get a beer day every 90 days. If you're at sea without touching land for more than 90 days, you get a beer day. What happens is they give you 2 tickets, and you get to go get 2 Bud Lights. 2. A lot of people sold their tickets. A lot of people acquired a bunch of tickets and got a little drunker than they should have. You can imagine drunk people on an aircraft carrier, bad things can happen. I was responsible. I always had my 2 beers, and I was good to go. But being at sea long enough to have 2 beer days was historic. When we finished my second cruise, we had made the longest aircraft carrier cruise in history. And after we did it, they said, well, if they can do it, everybody can do it. So they moved everybody's cruises from 6 months to 10 months. That's a long time to be at sea. But you get to see a lot of countries, which was exciting. And I cornered this rear admiral, and I said, sir, are we going to touch land soon? And he said, yes. I said, the rumor around the boat is we're going to Australia. And he said, yes. And that was just a treat to me. I always wanted to be going to Australia, you know. But just being able to go to these countries and be able to see the things that a lot of people don't get to see, you know. Back in the day, my dad's day, you know, when you go into, pull into port, there's a lot of single ladies out there waiting for you to come in, because there's people from the boat that go to shore and make sure that the town is ready for our arrival, right? Because 6,000 people descending on one town is a big thing. So the word spreads through the town that there's a ship coming, and a lot of vendors show up that weren't there 2 weeks prior, and they're trying to sell just about anything, you know, home country. I liked Australia. It was good times. But yeah, you get to see a lot of cool stuff.
That's so cool. Did you have a favorite place that you went?
Well, Singapore always holds a place in my heart. I went there 3 times. It's a big city. Lots of stuff to do. Weird laws. You remember that kid that got caned over there? Oh, you guys were too young for that. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
He did something that I can't even remember. I think he just did graffiti or something like that. He got 20 lashes with a cane. You can't spit. If you spit on the sidewalk, you get caned. You get arrested. There's no bubble gum in Singapore. None. You can't buy bubble gum. You can't get it. You can't have it. Right before you pull into the ship, they start selling it in the stores, so you can't have it, you know? Because there's a little store on the ship. But I liked Guam. Guam was beautiful. We spent 2 weeks in Guam while they resurfaced our flight deck because we had destroyed it over in Afghanistan. Sorry, I'm just remembering stuff. Guam was a lot of fun. There was a waterfall. It was a historic waterfall over there. It's called Telefufu Falls. Look it up. It's beautiful. There was actually a Japanese guy who got he was living in the caves over there at Telefufu Falls during the war. And he was in the caves for so long that the war ended and he didn't know it. And he was found, I believe it was 30 years later. It could have been 20 years. I don't remember. He was living off the land out of the cave. And he was only found because there were some hikers that had gone into the area and he had attacked them. And so they reported to the police and the police went in and found him and had to, you know, talk this guy down because he thinks there's a war still going on. And they talked him down and brought him out. And now there's a nice little plaque and pictures of him coming out of the cave and stuff like that over there. It's very historic. But beautiful waterfalls, fun to jump off of, big pool. Nice warm water. You get to swim with sea turtles. You know, largest cell phone bill I ever had. For some reason, our cell phones worked in Guam. I don't know if it was because it's a part of the U.S. now, not an official state, but apparently it's a roaming charge, and I didn't know it. I got was an $11,000 phone bill, and I had to call in and tell them that I was a little upset about that. I got out of it. I didn't have to pay it, but yeah, it was pretty interesting.
Wow. Do you have any other questions? Do you want to take over? Or do you want me to keep?
You can keep going. All right. I'm good for right
just
now.
Just a time check. Okay. I have to leave in about 30 minutes for an internship
okay.
thing. I am at...
This one, I mark it.
Okay. Again, great. What kind of actions did you witness or duties away from the front line?
Well, I was never on the front line. I did eventually. It's hard for me to answer that question because I was stationed on aircraft carrier. My carrier was the first one over there after September 11th. My squadron was the first squadron to drop bombs over there. It's, like I said, it's a historic squadron. I'm pretty sure that is why we were given the opportunity. I remember the day that we launched our aircraft. We had several aircraft fly off the aircraft carrier. We were the first ones to fly off. And 4 hours later, remember, I was working on nights, right? So if you can imagine, take you down memory lane here. You launch aircraft. 4 hours later, you get the word something big is about to happen. You work in the parachute shop, so you have cool toys to play with, including night vision goggles. Me, my best man, and two kids that worked with me, we all grabbed night vision goggles and we went out on the catwalk. Now, there's not a light in sight. You can't see anything. It's just pitch black as far as you can see. And you see stars, but you can't really tell where they stop and where they start. We all walked out on the catwalk and we all turned on night vision goggles all at once. And what we saw out in front of us was spectacular. There was a whole aircraft carrier group, battle group. There was 8 different destroyers, which we only had 4 in our battle group, but there was 8. And they were all lined up all around us. And what they were getting ready to do was launch the Tomahawk missiles into Afghanistan. What they had to do was time it at the exact same time that our aircraft got overhead to drop bombs. So there was a 4-hour lag between when we first launched and when they launched the Tomahawk missiles. Now the Tomahawk missiles, they come out of the aircraft, or they come out of the ship, and they go up 100 feet. And then they level off, and they take off. And they fly 100 feet over the ground all the way to their target, and then they drop and boom. That's it. So we're standing on an aircraft carrier, which is 75 feet, our catwalk where we were, 75 feet above the water. And all around us are all these destroyers. And all at the same time, they all start launching their missiles, and we're watching with through night vision goggles. It was the most spectacular thing I have ever seen, and I'll never forget it, ever.
That's crazy.
I'm sure. So, okay. To this one?
Yeah.
There, yeah. So how did you guys stay in touch with, like, people back home?
The journey from Singapore, we were in Singapore, 2 days out of Singapore. It took us a week to finally get orders, and we didn't move. We just sat there stagnant in the water waiting for orders because you get better signal when you're not moving. We got orders to go. We left. We went over there, and it took us a little under a month to get over there. We had to get to the right spot. Our pilots were looking at a 8-hour flight into Afghanistan just to be able to drop. Well, 8 hours in and 8 hours back. Like I told you, they locked down communication, so there was no communication. I would say probably 2 to 3 weeks after our first strikes. So before the country, until after the entire world knew that we were there, they didn't let us write or send emails or call or anything like that. When I was on the aircraft carrier, there was no such thing as Skype. It didn't exist. Nowadays, they have better communications and better abilities, higher speed internet, but it's still all satellite. So it's still spotty. The most used way to communicate was email. But they do have phones that you can call. Very expensive, like $3 a minute. So it costs a lot of money. You call home and say, hey, I'm doing all right. That's just about it. But those were the most common ways of communication.
Okay. So what did you do in your off-duty pursuits, is what they say?
2 weeks before I went in the Navy, I bought a camera, and I started shooting and found out I was pretty good at it. So through my military career, I had a camera, got robbed, lost my camera, gave up on photography because I was just so depressed about it. A couple years later, I bought another camera. I've been shooting photography for a long time now, almost 16 years, 17 years now. That's really what got me through it. It's just shooting things around me, everything in my perspective, what I see. And that's one of my favorite things to do. I mean, I remember taking pictures in Singapore of this cool fountain. It was a wet water wheel, and took time exposure pictures, and I mean, I had a lot of fun. But my wife still has a picture of a cat that I found in Japan hanging next to her bed. It was a metal cat, and it was a crazy cat. I mean, it was really weird Japanese art. But I got to experience different countries, different cultures, and I did it through photography, so that's what I did.
So where were you when the war actually is the war still going on, or is it done? I'm sorry, I told you I didn't know very much. Like, what are we doing right now, I guess?
So I'm gonna take this opportunity as a little learning.
Okay, good.
experience. Prior to September 11th, 2001, we were not at war.
Right.
We were still fighting in several countries. We were doing support, attack, blah, blah, blah. This war now has lasted longer than the Vietnam War. According to the president, Obama, we are pulling out no questions asked, everybody out in 2014. Who wins? If nobody says, I win, and president says, we give up, and we walk away, who wins? I call September 11th, I call at the war on Afghanistan, the war over there in Afghanistan, the forgotten war. Because there are people out there who don't understand why we're there. They don't know why we went. And there's a lot of confusion because of the Iraq war. Right? You know why we went to Iraq. Because Bush said, well, they got chemical war, you know, weapons over there of mass destruction. Even though there weren't. But he was told that there were. That's why we went. Because somebody told him that there were. Now, anybody on the street you walk up to and say, when was the last time you heard about something happening in Afghanistan? When was the last news story you heard?
God, I don't know.
You don't know. And the reason why you don't know is because the only time you ever hear about it is on September 11th. Right? We're only fighting one war right now, technically. I know a lot more. But we're only fighting one war. Do you think that this country could focus on one war for a week straight or a month straight or a year straight and understand what's going on over there? No. People don't know, and they don't know because they don't want to or they don't remember. There are no news stories about what's going on in Afghanistan unless a chopper goes down, somebody dies, there's another Afghan police force shooting where they shoot our troops in the back, right? Nobody knows about this war until something bad happens. And that's why I call it the Forgotten War. Much like Vietnam, when troops came home from Vietnam, there were people that spit on them, punched them, hit them. Call them baby killers, right? An interview like this would have never happened for a college student talking to a Vietnam vet. It never would have happened. So there's a bit of a difference between the fact that you two are sitting here talking to me and I'm telling you the story of how my life changed. One thing, this is a side note. One thing I used to do every year on September 11th is I used to gather everybody that worked for me in my office, and we would sit there in a room, and we would all go around the room and tell our stories. Where were you when September 11th happened? Where were you when those towers fell? I knew that I had been in long enough when I had a kid tell me I was in eighth grade. Some people don't remember it. But there's one thing that I believe that we all can remember is where we were that day. No matter how old you are, even if you're in second grade, you remember. Because it changed all our lives. But you should always remember where you were that day. And you should always remember that we're still over there fighting. And it's because we were attacked. It's not because we were pissed off. We wanted to invade a country and turn them into a democracy. That came along later, and people started to forget. And when people start to forget, that's when you have people that forget about the losses of what happened over there. Before this interview, I was over at Ace. I had to get some stuff. And when I walked out, I had a, I'd say, 75 to 80-year-old guy hobbling in towards Ace. And he had a hat on. And his hat said Vietnam veteran. And it had his medals on his hat. I walked up to him, and I shook his hand. And I thanked him for his service. Because they didn't ever get the thanks. They didn't ever get the respect. Until a couple of years ago, they never even had a welcome home parade. I was part of that welcome home parade, the first parade for the Vietnam vets. There's people out there that are still dying, and we need to always remember why we're over there. All right? Okay, back to your questions. Okay.
So I guess to change this question that they wrote, why did you leave and when did you leave? And
I got out in 2010, and I got out for a lot of reasons, some of which I won't tell you. I, like I said before, had two herniated discs in my back. I didn't know it at the time. I just had extreme back pain. The military, active duty military, they don't believe in chiropractic treatment as a treatment for back pain. I had been through physical therapy 3 times. I had a blown out shoulder. I had a stomach situation that I ended up finding out that I had a hiatal hernia. I had a lot of stuff going on medically, and I didn't want to sit around and wait for a medical discharge. It usually takes about 5 years. You have medical records, got to go for my board, and the board's got to decide whether or not you're fit for duty. If you're not fit for duty, and then they basically kick you out on a medical discharge. I knew that I had served honorably, and my time for reenlistment was coming. And I had already verbally committed that I was going to stay in for another 4 years. But I had a nice little sit down with my wife, and I told her, I don't ever want to deploy again. I don't want to be away from you. And I don't think I can physically take it anymore. You know, the stress of going to work every day with threat of imprisonment hanging on my shoulders. I had a lot going on in my head that I had to deal with. And so I voluntarily walked away. So that's why I left. And like I said, it happened in 2010. So
what was it like coming back, like to see your family and your community and your friends? Like, was it a relief or?
Well, so there are certain people in your life that you may know that are fully committed to their job. I was one of those people, and I never took leave. When I left the Navy, when I was getting ready to get out, I should say, I had 180 days of leave where I could have just taken 180 days off. Just, here you go. So what I ended up doing is I took 30 days off with my wife, and we rode in a car together from California to Virginia and back again. And we did this big loop across the United States. We were looking for a place to live. We were both from California, but we didn't want to stay in California because the taxes are too high, and screw that. We'd been there long enough to see the rest of the world, to see the rest of the country. So we went on a 30-day road trip looking for a place to live. And we did it in July, which was a bad idea. And we experienced some of the hottest temperatures on record, and we saw all of our family. I hadn't taken leave in 3 years, almost 3 years. So we hadn't seen anybody. So we took our leave, and we went and visited all our family and said, we don't want to live anywhere near any of these places. It's just too hot. It's too humid. It's not the right view, blah, blah, blah. So we ended up taking my grandfather's recommendation on the phone that we move here to Missoula. Well, Montana. So we started checking out VA hospitals because I knew I was going to end up needing some treatment. And we found that Missoula had a good VA system, you know, the whole system. And so we decided to move to Missoula. And when we moved here, we had all our stuff, and we had what we could carry. Everything else was being shipped here through the military. We didn't have a place to live. We had no idea what we were doing. And my wife found a rental in the newspaper out up 6 Mile. and out at Huson, we ended up moving into a 750 square foot log cabin in the middle of nowhere with no cell phone signal. And that was our first experience in Montana. And we lived out there for 2 years, and it was exactly what I needed. Because I went from so much stress to nothing. I spent most of my days out in the woods, cutting firewood, trying to make it through the winter, chasing squirrels away. But a lot of people that go to war, when they come home and they get out, that's the solitude that they seek. You know, I haven't been in Walmart in over 2 years. I can't be around that many people. When I talked with you and you said you want to meet at the library, I made sure that it was over here because I don't go to that campus because there's too many people over there for me. There's a lot of us that get out that just, we can't be around that many people because of what it's like over there in Afghanistan, because of what it's like on the carrier, because it's just too stressful. It was the solitude that we needed, you know, and it took me 2 years, but now I'm living down in Lolo, in a little city in Lolo, living on a hill, you know, so I can look out. But we're in a town now, so that's a big step forward. And I'm going to school, so that's another big step forward. But there you go.
Cool. So I guess you kind of answered this next. Do you think I should? Is that interesting to somebody in life? Do you think you pretty much cover that?
No, we're good.
Yeah.
I think this is pretty okay too.
I think this is really the only thing.
Okay.
Last question. What do you miss most about your time there?
Well, when I got out, I knew nothing about anything. You're a parachute rigger, and you get out. What are you going to do for a living? You know, there are people like my buddy, my best man. He was a mechanic. He learned how to weld in the military. He got out, and what is he? He's a welder. You know what I mean? So there are people that learn valuable job skills and can get out and do what they did in the military. What I miss most about being in the military was my job. I lived for it. I mean, every day I breathed it. I was the first one in. I was the last one to leave. I worked the longest hours. I was always on call. I never took leave. I was always there if they ever needed any questions asked. I answered questions I was stationed stateside, and I'd be getting questions from carriers, from people working on carriers that couldn't fix something. And I'd write them an email and tell them how to fix it. I knew my job, and I knew how to do what I did, and I did it good. And I miss that because I don't really have that. I'll get it. It just won't be in parachute rigging, but I do. I miss that. That's what I miss.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of lessons did you learn?
Work integrity. You know, if you're going to do something with your life, make it count. You know, make sure you live today because it's today. I don't live for tomorrow. I live for today because there might not be a tomorrow. You know, you never know when your time's up. And if you don't do everything that you can as far as what you're doing, it's pointless. You know, you better mean what you're intending to do. You better do it fully to the best extent that you possibly can. I don't believe in 110%. I don't believe in 150%. 100% is all you can give. But if you're not giving 100%, then there's no point in doing it.
Cool.
there anything else you want to add before we wrap up? Or
no, I think I'm good.
Okay.
This is good.
Good then.
Yeah.